Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know how to describe this man. He's one of life's characters. He is truly amazing. The world would be a very sad place without him. He's incredibly successful. He is still there. And he is Mr. Show Business, also Mr. Business, because he's very successful. And I didn't know his middle name was James. Who is it? Peter Stringfellow. Hello, Peter.
What a build-up, Peter.
But
thank
it's true. It's true. We go back.
That up, what it means is I'm very old.
Yeah, no, but so am I. So we're both old. We're both old. Now, I'm going to spend time with you because I want you to tell us your story. It is a hell of a story. You're still incredibly successful, never out the papers. And what I love about you, Peter, is you give something back to society all the time. So you're not... You're not a greedy person. You've done so much. I know your charity work, you keep quiet, but I'm going to say. So what I love about you is you're everything to everybody, and I admire you for that. Start at the beginning. Who's Peter Stringfellow?
Good grief, Pete. Peter, remember, in a couple of weeks' time, I'll be 75. So you're asking for my story, which we should probably take about 3 weeks.
Right.
If we start talking now, but I'll try and run that through to you. I'm a Sheffield boy, born and bred. I'm the beginning of the war, 1940, which I know nothing about, other than I remember searchlights and all clear sirens and fires. So I'm sure a lot of people my age in Liverpool have similar memories as well. But going back to Sheffield... working class was not exactly a term that anybody really used in those days, but that's what we were. And we lived in little tiny houses, which I suppose today we call slums, except that our areas were always clean, but very tiny, rain always coming, and all that kind of stuff. I'm telling you this as a build-up to who I am. And, of course, there was no money in the family. It was during rations, so there was no food, really, other than enough to keep going. Not that I remember being deprived of anything. Not really, because everyone was the same. So you didn't look at someone who was better off than yourself. You know, we all lived in the same kind of area, went to the same kind of schools. Cut a long story short, because of my semi-dyslexic, I call it semi, because I can't spell, never could, never can, and I have difficulty with long words when I'm trying to read them. So I never passed any exams, so... I eventually found myself in a technical school. I don't know how, but I did. But I was bottom of the class as per usual. And I left at 15. After many little funny jobs that you could get in those days, you know, a couple of pounds a week. But it was a job. And, of course, at that time, it was important. But me and Liverpool touched for the first time when I was 16 years old. And I read a story about Tommy Steele, who said that he'd joined the Merchant Navy, went to New York, bought a guitar, learned to play, came back, went to a coffee bar in London called Two Eyes, got discovered, and became a star. So at my age from Sheffield, I thought, well, I'll do that. So I went off to Liverpool, and I thought, that's where you went to join the Merchant Navy. And, of course, I was in the wrong place. There were beautiful liners in those days, and all the big buildings were all to do with what we probably now call cruise ships, but I don't suppose it was cruising in those days. It was a real thing, you know, going to New York and all that. So I eventually ended up joining the Merchant Navy. By the way, it came out of Grimsby area called Goole, and went to New York, surprisingly, but unlike Tommy Steele, who was on a liner and became a waiter, I was on a tanker and became a kitchen hand, known as a galley boy, but really known as a slave. So, I mean, and that's how I was treated, but I never seen so much food in my life, so I kind of like half liked it, half didn't, but I liked the bit I could eat what the hell I wanted, and because I'm a Sheffield boy, I looked in the big fridges, and there was all these meats and everything, and you know what I used to eat more than anybody else when I could eat anything?
Go on.
Bread and jam. Wow. I couldn't believe the size of the jam jars. They were massive. Wow. So right there I was having my share. Came out of the Merchant Navy, actually got to New York, couldn't afford a guitar, couldn't wait to get off the boat, went back to Sheffield, learnt how to drive, tried to get driving jobs, bumped into a job called a door-to-door salesman, learnt how to do that, bumped into Liverpool again, a guy called Gus Andrews. I hope he's somebody in his family listens. And he was in Sheffield from Liverpool as a photography company, taking photographs of kids and the film would go back to Liverpool and it would be hand-painted in Liverpool and sent back, and such as me would then pick it up, go and see the person who had their lovely child on this and sell them the photograph for 59 and sixpence in a plastic frame.
Wow.
And I was making very nearly £20 a week, which was twice my dad's wage, you know. Mm-hmm. And I went to Liverpool to actually, so I must have been about 19. And then they sent me off to Newcastle. Anyway, cut another long story short. I eventually got myself into a little trouble by one of the selling jobs, which I started selling some of their stock, which I wasn't supposed to be selling. Mm-hmm. In other words, I was fiddling.
Mm-hmm.
And I was found by the police, and I'd stolen approximately £65 worth, which sent me to prison for 8 weeks. I mean, today now, they'd apologise for having brought you to court, give you £20 and send you home in a taxi. But in those days, it was pretty heavy stuff. But those 8 weeks in prison changed my life. From coming out of there, I decided that's it. Never again would I do anything remotely illegal because I was frightened to death of prison. I went to the real thing, not the ones now. I went to what you only ever see in black and white movies with Humphrey Bogart or Edward G. Robinson today on films. But again, I kind of found something interesting and fun in there, as much as I disliked it. When I came out, I couldn't get a job. Now we get into the meat of the game. No one would give me a job because I'd been to prison. So I ended up, once again, working for myself. And then, hey, lo and behold, what happened? A friend of mine bumped into a group called Johnny Tempest and the Cadillacs. And he was running them around for approximately £3 per trip. And I said, this is wonderful. I had a big van in those days, so I looked around, couldn't find one of them. And then he told me that this group used to go to these halls, and one was the Chesterfield City Hall, and they would fall every Saturday night, and this band would play. So I went to see the band, and there was approximately 800 kids in this place, all screaming and yelling and having a good time to this Johnny Tempest and the Cadillacs. And they were all paying 2 and 6 months to go in. 2 and 6 months being half a crown being, I think, approximately 12 and a half p today. So being the kind of guy I was, I went to the little guy on the door and I said, how much are you paying the group? And in his usual lovely accent, he said, what's that I want to know for? Which meant, you know, none of your business. I found out he was paying them £12. And the one thing I was good at, dyslexic or not, was arithmetic and math. So I added up 800 off of crowds, which came to 100 quid. I then said, well, who gets the other? And that's when he tried to have me thrown out. So at that point, I saw my friend who were running the band around. I said, my God, do they know how much money's been taken here? He said, well, they're quite happy. He got an extra 10 shillings this week, £12.10. So I immediately started looking for places to put a group on, found a church hall called St. Aidan's Church Hall, just up from the city itself in Sheffield. I had a chat to the old vicar called Vicar Jerome. We agreed for £3 I could rent it on a Friday night. I went and saw a local band called The Pursuers, booked them. Put them on, lost £20. Couldn't believe it. But I liked what I'd done. I'd been on stage and I'd been underneath a spotlight with a microphone. Let me just tell you what the spotlight was. It was a car's headlight attached to a 6-volt battery. But Peter, this is where you and I are going to touch, you know, an understanding. When that spotlight hit me on stage and I got the microphone in my hand, I immediately became incredibly good looking. People were taking note of me, and I even got a few nods and smiles from the girls. And I came off stage, and that particular, I took a girl home, which I hadn't done before, as easy as that. And I thought, this is the business for me. So the next week, I put the same band on, lost another £20. And I got what I call a watershed. The third week, it was Dave Berry and the Cruisers, who's still running around Great Britain now.
Yep.
The original Dave Berry. And, of course, everyone knew him from a record called The Crying Game. But at the time, he was what we didn't understand was rhythm and blues. And of course, that was getting near to Merseybeat Sound. And I put him on, and I made £65. So, hey, I was in business. So I finished the job I was working, never worked for anybody since. After that, Johnny Tempest played for me after Dave Berry. I made another £65. Now, let's get a bit nearer to Liverpool. After a few weeks, I'm really enjoying this, but I'm making some money then, not enough. Not another £20, not another 60, should I say. But then a girl came up to me one Friday and said, have you got a record by a group called The Beatles? I said, I don't know. Because we just put records on just to fill in between the groups. We didn't put records on to entertain anybody.
Yep.
They were like waiting for the group to come on. I said, no, I'll have a look. I said, no, I ain't got that. She said, well, can you get it? Because we like it. I said, okay. So the next Friday, I was playing it called Love Me Do. And I went, as I put it on, some of the girls started screaming. Went outside. I thought it was a fight because it was in Sheffield. And they were just screaming. I said, what are you screaming for? I said, we like the Beatles. I said, but you know, I hear it's a record. We still like the Beatles. So then next day, I got the New Musical Express or the Melody Maker, one of the two. And there was an advert, 1 inch by 1 inch, which said, the Beatles, record in the charts, Love Me Do, ring Brian Epstein. So I did. I rang and spoke to Brian himself. I was in a phone box outside my little church hall, which by now, by the way, I'm calling the Black Cat Club. Don't ask me why. I can't remember. Probably because it sounded American. Anyway, and I did a conversation on the phone with Brian, and at the time he was in his father's store, and I think he was looking after the record shop there, and he asked for an incredible £50. And I said, that's impossible. I pay Screaming Lord Such and the Savages £50, and they come from London. Whereas your guys, nobody's ever heard of them. Mm-hmm. And I was making a bit of money on Screaming Lord Such. So the very next day, I went back on the phone and I said, look, I've changed my mind. I'll take them for £50. And he said, sorry, it's gone up. It's 75. I said, no, I can't imagine paying 75 quid. So I put the phone down, third day I rang him up, I said, OK, I'll have it. He went, £100.
Wow.
So we came to an agreement on £85. Now, let me just tell you, Peter, at the time, that was an astonishing amount of money for me. I'm trying to work out how the hell I'm going to make any money out of this little group. So the next, but there was something magical about what was happening with the Beatles. I mean, there was something that's never happened since. I don't care what the kids say today. They can point to, you know, One Direction, whatever they're called. Nothing magical like the original Beatles.
Yeah, I agree.
So what happened was, we agreed, £85. And I came up that very same weekend. The record dropped out from number 17, the highest it ever got, to 34. And I thought, well, that's it. Goodbye, 85 quid. But anyway, I hadn't got a contract to it. I thought, well, I'll not cancel them until I get the contract. You never know. And then, of course, the magic took off and people started talking about the Beatles. So by now, this was November-ish, 1962, and I got the booking for February the following year, 63. By the time January came round, people were talking about the Beatles. People were sending me money because I put an advert, and it was picked up by New Musical Express and the musical papers that they were going to play at the Black Cat Club, Sheffield, and they were sending me postal orders. Now, I know a lot of your young kids listening to this don't know what a postal order is, but you know.
Yeah.
Kind of like a check. Yeah. My God, they probably don't even know what a check is. okay, it's like money sent through the post. It's not real money. You go to the post office and you get some money for it. All right, did you understand that? I know you did, Peter. So let's move on. So they kept sending me all this money, and I kept sending them all tickets, thinking this is wonderful. And then one day I counted up the tickets, and that sold 1,000. And at my little church hall, if everybody breathed together and went mad, we would probably be able to squeeze and kick in about 600. This is way before there were legal limits, mm-hmm. way before.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, this is still, and they're still sending me these post orders. So I went and did a deal with the local, I would call it a ballroom, real ballroom, you know, like Strictly Come Dancing, one of those places. Yeah.
Like the Rialto, those type of places.
Yeah, so, and of course, the old ballrooms were like that in those days. Anyway, I rented it off this guy called Mr. Fiddler. What a great name. And it was named after his wife, called Azina, who was one of the Sheffield local Strictly Come Dancing kind of champions. And she was wearing these, like, Dame Edna average glasses and a big sparkly dress. And she said, what kind of people come to watch this group? I said, oh, lovely people, absolutely lovely. She said, what kind of music did they play? I said, oh, lovely music. She said, what do you look like? I said, lovely, really lovely people. So I got the booking. And then, lo and behold, come January, they released a record called Please Please Me, which shot up there. And by the time they played for me, I think it was the 17th of February, you guys out there in Liverpool can get out your date books, your history books. You'll find that whatever date it was that Please Please Me got to number one, they played for me on that day.
Wow.
And I picked them up in a rented little Ford Anglia. I picked them up from our one and only hotel in Sheffield called the Grand Hotel. I don't know what they were doing there. They weren't staying there. I think they just got off to been dropped there from the train or something. And I ran them up to this ballroom, and they were screaming with laughter, saying, we might be number one, we might be number one. I'm going, this is great, yeah. And I'm thinking, if they're number one, I'm going to make a fortune. Mm-hmm. So we were laughing together, and it was the four kids and me. So it was five kids just screaming and laughing and having a good time for what was happening to all five of us. They were going to be the most famous thing in the world, and I was about to make quite a few quid. So, you know, I was happy too. When we got to the ballroom, I'd forgotten I sold another 1,000 tickets, so there's 2,000 tickets out there. And this ballroom had got the figure, according to the lady that owned it, of 450.
What?
Which, of course, I know by the ballroom it could take more than that. Cut another long story short, when she saw the crowd, she fainted. This is a true story. And her husband, old Fiddle, he says to me, my God, you can't let all these in. I said, I've got to. They're here. He said, it'll cost you a bit more. I said, what? So from agreeing, I think it was 20-odd quid for the night, he put a little tenner on top.
Wow.
So while his wife's laid out trying to come round, we did a deal for 35 quid. So we let them all in. They actually destroyed the pool, you know, the dance hall, of course, because I mean, it was all shiny floor when they went in. It was like sandpaper when they left it. Yeah. And the Beatles on stage, and I went on stage, and I've got a photograph of me in front of the Beatles, me with my DA greasy hair, and them looking like the Beatles. And I was introducing them. And nobody heard a word, Peter. For a whole half hour, it was just screaming, screaming, screaming. But what an excitement. And that day changed my life, because when it all ended, the boys went. Sadly, they took with them the telegram. Peter, explain what a telegram is after this.
That's postal orders and telegrams.
Congratulating them would be number one. Yeah. And they took it with them.
Wow.
Anyway, at that night, when it had all gone, I was stood outside this ballroom. This woman, I think she'd been to hospital for a heart attack or something like that. And I was looking, and I thought, I want some more of this. This is what I want. I'd been on stage with the Beatles, as far as I was concerned. There was something magical even at that time. They went on to be incredibly famous, like worldwide, within that 1 year. As you remember, it was, was it 63 or 64 they went to America. I couldn't book them again. Brian Epstein was wonderful because, you know something, I never got a contract. What happened was John Lennon gave me the contract and said, Brian sent you this. I said, will you sign the bottom and so he can take the other one back? I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
He could have cancelled on me.
He could have done
and never did.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And the story goes on. He offered me a job eventually, being the compere for all the shows we were putting out. So I did the very first one. So he offered me to compere in Coventry, and I've got little poster somewhere, and top of the bill was Cilla Black. This has got to be 63, 64-ish. She can't be any later than that. And she'd just had first big hit record, whichever it was. And on the same bill was Brian's new protege called Tommy Quickly, which Tommy never made it, of course. But he was second on the bill. Third on the bill was The Foremost, which we all know about. And I went along and did that. And then he offered me the job to go and be the compare to all his shows. But by then, I'd got a couple of places. So it must have been 64-ish probably, because I've got the Black Cat Club, the Blue Moon Club, and I was about to open the Mojo Club. They all sound wonderful, but they were all little dumps, which had great atmosphere, a bit like the old cavern stuff, you know. And so I said, no, I want to continue doing what I'm doing. Mm. And I was right. And but he was a lovely man, and he would always answer my phone calls. Mm.
That's a great story about you.
We're still in the 60s, and you want to know my story?
Yeah, no, that was a great story with your connection in Liverpool. Let's move on now to the Millionaires, and let me set this up. Ladies and gentlemen, for those people that never went, when this man opened the Millionaires Club in Manchester, the whole country was talking about it. There was nothing like it. There was really, truthfully, nothing like it. And Julian Russell, who works for Peter now, actually ripped it off and called it atmosphere in Birkenhead.
Of course, Julian works for me, sitting in my next office, pretending to be working because he's a crap worker.
And he's listening. Tell us about the Millionaires, because that was something very special.
Well, it was the first purpose-built, glamorous, high-profile, bloody expensive to build nightclub. I mean, you could say it was the first disco as such, but it was very glamorous, very beautiful. But it was made for me to be on stage with my massive ego, if you remember those days, Peter. And I was on stage. I was surely the first guy ever to turn the decks at my back, so I was facing the audience with my microphone. By then, as you probably know, I'm sure you do know, I was a DJ and getting my kicks, not only in my clubs, but getting on stage and being a DJ. Famous in my own little lunchtime, as you would say in those days, and having a super time. And that continued for all my life, because whilst I owned my clubs, I was always in them, part of them.
And you always made
sure we never got a chance, all that kind of stuff.
You always made sure it ran properly too. You never took your eye off the ball. And very clever, which I always remember, you and Bernard Manning had something in common. You used and worked with your family so you couldn't be fiddled.
Well, I did remember, trust me, Peter. Enough people fiddled me over the years. I mean, to this day, we won't go into it. But of course, your family doesn't, and what I've always liked to do is to make people family as well, like Julian Russell just mentioned. Mm-hmm. I first met him at the Millionaire Club, and after that he came to London to work for me when things went not so clever with him at the time, and his marriage at the time. And then from there he went on to manage the Hippodrome for me during its heyday. Then he went to New York and managed that for me. Then he left me and opened his own club. Then he went to own a big restaurant in Washington, America. Then he came back to me again. So it's kind of having family close to you at that level.
No, it's nice. Now, Peter, let's talk about your dyslexia. You're an incredibly successful man and a very powerful man. How much of a problem has it been, if a problem at all?
Well, it was a problem as a kid because we didn't know anything. All I knew, the teachers like tried to help me, but I was ticked down as being thick, and that was it. You know what I mean? Bottom of the class, couldn't spell to save my life. You know, in those days, you would take English, and then they would ask you to make a composition, meaning a story. And my stories were always three sentences long, when they've asked for three pages. That's because, you know, if it was do a story about an aeroplane crashing, I go super. Here we go. Hey. I once saw an aeroplane in the sky, and I saw it crash. End of story. Because then I would have trouble spelling plane, because once I spelled it once, I forgot how to spell it again. And crash would be all right. I was all right with SH. I was all right with that. The big change for me, Peter, came when I got my King Mojo Club, and I found myself a secretary. And she was only a young girl herself, which is still known as Jilly Mojo. And then she could dictate. I mean, I could dictate to her, and she could do shorthand. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to explain shorthand as well, obviously. But
you could say what you wanted to say, but you just couldn't spell it. So it was great that somebody...
I had no problem saying stuff. To this day, Peter, once you know where you are in life, and for anyone who is dyslexic, don't hide it. Don't kid about it. Say, hey, I'm sorry, I can't spell. I can't say that. I can't read that word. I can't memorize that particular page. And then once you've done that, you find what you can do. And what I know I can do is give me a microphone and I can ad-lib my way through anything. but I cannot work with a script.
Yeah.
And people have tried me with that. They've tried put me in so many TV shows, and he's like, well, we give you a script. I said, no, forget the script. What do you want me to talk about?
Yeah.
Well, no, it's a serious script. You've got, so well, just give me a rough idea, and I'll say what comes. So obviously that limited me, and that's why I'm not a film star living in Hollywood, which, of course, if I could read a script, that's where I would be today. It's like I should be a rock star, a rock god, really, but I can't remember words to the songs, and I can't keep a tune, and I can't play an instrument. So I'm slightly limited. Yeah. But if, apart from that, I got everything else going.
Peter, if it's any consolation, we both sing off the same hymn sheet over this, because I struggle. I mean, I do panto every year, but I need my script in July for January, because I am in a terrible state. Now, let's talk about Stringfellas. Now, was this a myth or was this a fact? Because this was something that freaked me out when I found out that you did it. You opened Stringfellas in London, which cost you an arm and a leg. Outside, the first week was every car from a Ferrari to a Rolls Royce, and nobody could get in because you were closed and full. But in fact, you weren't. It was just a facade to build up the image, and then it took off. Is that right or wrong?
A lot of truth in that, because what I realised very quickly was that London was not Manchester, and it was not Leeds and Sheffield, where I'd remember, you jumped over a couple of clubs I owned in Leeds called Cinderella Rockefeller.
Oh, yes. And that was two separate clubs, wasn't it?
Sheffield, yeah. The King, yeah. Mojo Club. And I was booking the American stars, like little Stevie Wonder, a new act called Ike and Tina Turner, and then Jimi Hendrix for the first time for £50, the Small Stafers for £25, the Who, yeah, for £60, the Rolling Stones for £120, and on it goes. And that's, of course, in the 60s when I bumped into Bob Wooler, the old Bob Wooler at the Cavern Club, and I got a group played there called the Skeletons, which I made the name up to get them into Liverpool. And they played at the Cavern. Mm-hmm. I took just about every group that was in Liverpool at the time trying to make a name for themselves after the Beatles, and I booked them all. Ever, let's go back to what you've just said there.
Stringfellas, yeah.
When it comes to the original Stringfellas. Well, because I'd been to a club before then called Laval Bomb, which was a wonderful club in the 60s. And but he did a lot of business with the Arabs. And outside his club, he got all these flashy cars which belonged to the Arabs. So being a northern boy, I thought, hey, that's what I'll do. So I put the word out that in those days, you could park outside Stringfellas on two lines. Politically correct crap has taken over around in London like everywhere else. And those days are gone.
Mm-hmm.
But you used to have Camargs, all different colors, Ferraris, different colors. And I thought, I've got to give these guys some reason to want to come in here, not just because I'd built the best club in the world, which it was at the time, but I had to give them a message. So, yeah, I mentally closed the door at a certain time and told my guy, Tom, we're full. That's it, we're full. And they were, the more they could get in, the more they wanted to get in. That didn't last too long because I couldn't stand the suspense. Yeah. My God, are they still standing outside? Yeah, okay, let them in.
Yeah.
So, but the whole street, which is now still known as Upper St. Martin Street, I remember being at least four or five Camargs there, all different colours.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way it was in those days. It was lovely.
Peter, every star in the world has been in your club. Why did you change it? What was the reason for changing it over?
Well,
from
like
what?
A lot of things that I've changed in my life, Peter. If you want the absolute truth, I did it for money. Not because I got this wonderful idea one day, I dreamt of this, and God said, do that. None of that rubbish. what was happening is that the disco business was going down nice. You know, it was the big recession came in at 93. I'd already lost a lot of money in my clubs in America. I'd opened in New York, I'd opened in Miami, I've opened in Beverly Hills, and their recession started in 1990. And that cost me millions. All the money I'd made, I started losing. But I bumped into this girl business in Miami. I met a guy called Michael J. Peters, who is firstly like similar to me in the girl business over there. But it was his ideas. And quickly, I did a deal with him to reopen my club in New York, having closed it because of we were making no money at all. And I was ready for, in fact, I did go bankrupt. Over there, you have something called Chapter 11, which is one step before you go bankrupt, which is then called Chapter 7, which I've already done that as well, by the way, over there. So anyway, so I took the girl business up to New York, and at the instant hit my hands, Peter, we're running over a lot of like months of work and ideas, but nonetheless, let's just say I took the girls into New York, made a fantastic success, saved my ass from complete and utter bankruptcy so that I would be thrown into prison, but the girl business saved it for me. But I was too late to save my whole thing in America, and I had to sell what I'd made there and come out. So I came back, of course, mentally to only to Stringfellow's. That's all I got left. And I thought, I'm going to put the girl business in here. It took me 3 years to get the license. It's just something I knew in my heart was going to work. And I got my staff together and told them, frightened them to death. You know, they'd all got mortgages. Frightened, you're going to do what? And when I told the local police what I was going to do, they thought I'd gone absolutely mad. I remember saying to this guy, look, these girls come to your table side, they take the clothes off, you give them £10. In America, it's $10. And this policeman said, wait a minute. He was a sergeant. He came back with the chief inspector. He said, tell him what you've just told me. This chief inspector stood there with his hat and his stick under his arm going, absolutely not. There's no nick and this coming like that in clubs in London. You know, he said, he'll be fighting and there'll be drugs. I said, no, they don't. I said, you just watch. There's no fighting. Anyway, another long story short, I did it for the money, Peter. It was the best thing I did. I remade my fortune by bringing the adult entertainment, that's what I call it, by the way, the adult entertainment industry into Great Britain. And I've had a stunning success with Stringfellow's. I have this lovely club here where I'm speaking to you as well in Soho called Angels. And to this day, it was one of the best things I ever did. Coming to London was one of the best things. Opening in Manchester was. Opening in Leeds was. Opening my little Mojo Club in Sheffield was. Bucking the Bills was. I can't say going to prison was, but it certainly set me up because that's after that, I had to work for myself. And my mentality had always and always has been to rely upon what I do and my own decisions then.
I've got to tell you a story which you don't know, I don't think. You opened a course in Ireland.
Yes, I did.
And we went over to see Julian, and there was a group of very, very nice people. And we went over there, and there was people outside, nuns and everybody, saying evil because of the women. So picture this. So they're going, evil, evil. And they said, are you going in there? And I went, I'm gay. And they went, oh, evil, evil. And they went off the head, so they had to go at me then because I was gay, so I didn't have any chance, but I loved it over there. What I love about what you do is, and I go in there and I still shake my head in disbelief, they are some of the most beautiful women in the world.
I like to think so, Peter, but in truth, I should know what I'm talking about by now, and they are the most beautiful girls in the world.
Why are you a womanizer?
Well, it's a bit like what you asked me, why did I do it? I did it for money, because when that little spotlight hit me at the Black Cat, it wasn't the Black Cat, it was the St. Aidan's Church Hall, my whole ego and mentality changed from being a normal guy that had to chase girls. All of a sudden, I got girls interested in me. And rather than try and work this out, I just went with it. I thought, right. This is all right. Yeah. So I started believing that I was also, you know, Brad Pitt before Brad Pitt, if you know what I mean. And I just went with the flow. And I've often thought back, my God, I mean, I was terribly unfaithful to both my first two wives. But that's the kind of thing, if I say it was all right in those days, of course it wasn't all right. But, you know, I was on the edge of the showbiz, rock and roll business, and every rock band has got a similar story. You know, if you look at some of these bands, you know, why do women want to go with them? And no doubt, you know, you can put me in that list as well, you know. I mean, when I look at myself in the mirror, I do see an incredibly good-looking 32-year-old instead of a 74-year-old whose hair is thinning out terribly and going very grey. But my wife loves me, and that suits me fine.
Are you?
But I stopped womanizing 12 years ago.
Are you a happy man?
I'm a very happy little girl who is 2 years old, who is the, you know that silly saying, apple of my eye? Well, she's every fruit you can think of in my eye. I just adore looking at her. My wife is pregnant. Luckily, I'm the father, before anybody says anything. And we're having our little boy in September. And yes, I'm a very happy man. I'd like to be richer, Peter. I mean, like anyone else listening, I'd love to be a lot richer than I am. But I can't be any happier.
Is life harder in London now, to the years you've been there? Is it different?
Well, I've been here 35 years, so it's the longest I've ever been in any city. So with all respect to where I come from, I feel strongly very affinity with London. I feel as one, but not London per se. Mm-hmm. I'm the West End. I'm within the centre of London. What I know about is the West End of London. When we move on to Chelsea, it's like, you know, moving to another country. So is it tough? Yeah, London's getting tougher by the day. I don't know why the councillors do, but they hate cars. We've got people arguing about whether you're Uber, you're a black cab, which is a terrible thing in itself. And on it goes. It is a tough city. It's so full, there's traffic, there's people. But at the same time, it's an incredibly exciting city, because everything is possible here. And I remember going to Liverpool to the Cavern Club, and nothing was more exciting than you were going to Liverpool. My God. And somewhat, people who remember that era, that's how it's been with me ever since, whichever city I've moved into. I got very involved with New York. I got involved with Miami. I didn't like Beverly Hills, by the way. And LA and me can live quite happily without each other. But Miami and New York were great. And London is a very special city of can-do. If you want to do it, you can. But it is getting tougher because the rents here for freehold permit are astronomical. Just in case anyone's thinking of coming down and coming in competition with me, let me put you off. Because the rents are out of this, out of world. But nevertheless, there's always something around the corner. There's always another reason to love London. It's easy to complain about anywhere, isn't it?
Peter?
But London, I live on the Albert Embankment. I don't have a garden. Instead, I've got the Thames, which is fine. And my view is the Big Ben and the London Eye and, of course, Westminster itself.
Peter, so, are you a hard taskmaster to work for?
No, I think I'm a bit of candy floss. I think I'm a marshmallow. I am not. I've tried to read, yet again, Richard Branson's book. Is that one that's number four in the charts? I've got to page four and I put it down again. I cannot read. I love Richard in his own way, but, you know, I don't know. To tell the true story of who you are and what you are, a lot of these guys don't do that. I did write a book, and I know you wrote yours as well, Peter. My book came out in 1996, just before I chained string pillows to the girls as I was doing it. So I think I was brutally honest about myself and what kind of guy I have been during that period. I'm not going to do a number two because I read what you said once. You're going to die before you put your second book out.
Yes.
Well, that goes for me too, Peter, all right? In fact, I better not do that either, come to think of it.
Are you a good father?
I happen to be an incredible father because whatever my little girl says, I do. Much to the upsetting my wife, who says I'm just like a pushover. Which father with a little girl is not a pushover?
But you have other children.
I have two other children, yeah. My little girl's sister, or my little girl's sister, is 52. There's 50 years difference. My little girl's brother is 49.
Wow.
I've got grandchildren, which are teenagers, of course, you know.
Wow.
But I'm a funny granddad in that respect because, you know, I'm different to their other friends' granddads.
Peter,
do you have to say any more than that?
Peter, do you get frightened about getting old, or does it never cross your mind?
No, I'd rather not get old, but luckily I get pretty good looking as I get older. I don't know if I'm kidding myself, but if I was a girl, I'd quite fancy me, actually, you know.
Well, most of them do, Peter, I've got to be honest.
Of myself in the glass plate dividing myself from Julian. I'm a lot better looking than him, I'll tell you that. And look at him now. God, he's a mess for his age, and he's younger than me.
Stop.
What's... I don't want to get old. I'm left to stay as I am now. Incredibly good looking at 75. No doubt when I'm 94, I'll be probably one of the best looking 94-year-old guys alive. That's if there's anybody else alive at 94.
Will we still see you in the G-string?
Listen, last time I put a G-string on and make sure all the lights were off. No, I don't think you're going to see me anytime soon with a G-string. No, no, no. However, you know, yeah. If my wife wants to see me in a G-string, I'll put the bugger on. I don't mind. I'll put it in my head if she likes it.
What's the future for Pete Stringfellow?
I don't know, Peter. All I know is that every time I think I've got it all wrapped up and I know what I'm doing, something changes. But isn't that wonderful about life? Yeah. You know, if you're really, really new. Sometimes, you know, I do talks at Oxford and Cambridge. I'm not telling that to impress anybody. It's the truth. And I look at these lovely young people in front of me, and what I like to tell them is this. You obviously think you know where you're going in life. Let me tell you something. You don't. And they're looking, what do you mean? Yeah. I said, what I mean is you've got no idea where you're going. Because whatever you think you're going to do now, that's not going to happen. Something else is going to happen. Yeah. You don't know, and I can't tell you. But that's the way my life is, and I think that's a great way for life to be.
I've interviewed a lot...
tomorrow, you know?
Peter, I've interviewed a lot of very successful people, and I always ask them this question. How and what advice would you give to people out there who want to be Pete Stringfellow, who want to be successful, who want to go down that journey you've been? What would you say to them?
I would say only do it if you are passionate. And I mean that with every word, every syllable of that word, every letter of the word, the real meaning of passion, that's what you wake up for in the middle of the night and think about. That's what you think about in the morning. It's in front of everything you've ever got or have. Whatever it is, that passion you want to do, go with it. Now, the next piece of advice is don't do it if you're not passionate, because what a horrible way to live, and failure is waiting for you. Also, don't be frightened of failure, because I've failed many, many times, right from being a kid at school through business. I've been bankrupt, I've had voluntary arrangements, I've been in and out of success, I've been at times when it looks like I've had it, and the other times when it looks like I was the rising star, and things change. So don't be frightened of bumping into failure. But if you do bump into failure, get yourself back together again and learn from that failure. Now, that's the only advice I can give you, because people out there are not me and I'm not them. I can only tell you how I did it. And my advice would be do what you want to do, but have great passion for it, or don't do it. Don't be frightened of failure, otherwise you won't have success. And let me tell you about success. You don't really know how wonderful it is until you've tasted failure. Now, does that help anybody?
That's a very interesting statement. That really is, because, yeah, I love that, because you really don't know. You really don't know. And you look back and you go, oh, my word, yes, I was successful. But you've done it so many times, and now you're once again right at the top.
Well, I'm right at the top for now, Peter, but, you know, life moves and changes. I'm trying to get this social... I know you're on Twitter, you know I'm on Twitter, but what a mess I made of it. It's incredible. I mean, I didn't really want to be on Twitter, but my guy said, you should be on Twitter, you'll enjoy it, and it's good for business. So I got on, and I can't quite see where it's good for business, but I'm enjoying it, a bit of fun. I follow you, and I know you follow me. And I do a lot of things wrong on Twitter, I'm sure I do. But having said all that, I'm a bit lost with the social media thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and learn that one before I get too much older. Let's see where that's taken. It's because the world is changing, I mean, to the extreme. But then again, that's the good thing about life, you know?
When I was born, we
were at war. Everyone thought we were going to lose.
Peter.
But by the time I was 5 years old, Great Britain had won the war.
Meeting so many people, as you have done, everybody's been through your club. Do you still get a buzz out of certain people going, wow, I can't believe I've just met him?
Only if there's one or two. Look, I am a bit blasé in the nicest way, which means it doesn't surprise me that a big star walks into my club. But I'm not blasé that they've actually come to my club, I'm flattered, and that's the way I take it. I thank them, I have a sit with them. If they want a drink, fine. I'll leave them alone if they're just having a bit of fun. But I think I'm going to finish that bit of with this story, Peter. I was in Stringfellow's one day. I came in, and my maitre d', oh, excuse me, I'm getting a bit classy now. Okay, my head waiter. The Freudian slip from my past. My maitre d'. He said, Mr. Peter, over there, there's a man in a big chair. I think you may know him. I think he's famous. And so I look over, and there's this guy laid out in this chair. And I'm looking, astonishingly, at Professor Stephen Hawking.
Wow.
And I think, wait a minute. And I have the most stupidest thought I've ever had. And I thought, is that a lookalike? Because, and after that, what a stupid thought. I mean, I won't exaggerate, but afterwards I went over and introduced myself. And he'd got his carers there with him and his assistant called Mark. I remember Mark. And I said, look, Stephen, if I may call you Stephen, if you want to pop over and join me when you finished eating, they were feeding him the food on his table. And they brought him over to my table. And here comes the story with Stephen Hawking. We were sat there together, and I'm rambling on about the bloody universe, and because I've got this, I got a slight understanding of the string theory of multiple universes, blah blah blah. And of course, I'm looking at his eyes, and he's a bit glazy looking at the stage. So I said, "Look, Steve, I don't want to bore you, but you know, I just love talking to you. Actually, I'm talking to myself, but I said I love talking to you. I said, but if you just want to look at the girls, that's okay." And at the time, he could speak through this box.
Yeah.
And through the box, he just said, the girls.
What a put down!
That was the end of my conversation with the most intelligent man in the universe. And the irony was just beyond. He wanted to see the bloody girls, and I wanted to talk about the universe. And that was that. Anyway, he went on to have a wonderful time, hopefully. So there you have it. That's probably...
Mm. That's a great story.
Names that like Jack Nicholson and that kind of stuff. But I would say, to this day, it still sticks that Professor Stephen Hawking...
Yeah. The girls. I love that. The girls.
He told me something very confidential at the time, which I then told the press, of course. And I said to him, I don't understand why you haven't been knighted. I said, I've got a theory that you've turned it down. And he just went, yes. So he has been offered a knighthood, yeah. And he's turned it down. Otherwise, why has he not got a knighthood? That's ludicrous, don't you think so?
Serious question. The girls, who are stunningly beautiful, are they happy, or is it just the money? Or explain. Are they happy people?
It's a combination of two things, Peter. They're happy that they get the money. In other words, money makes you happy. Money's always made me happy, because I always say this, you know, the only times I've been really, really unhappy is when I had no money.
Yeah.
You know, no money to me means being in Sheffield with no coal on the fire and being cold. That is horrible. What is happy is coal being lit and a little house being nice and warm means you could afford the coal. I don't want to try and get too hypey here, but money is a very important thing in our lives, and it continues to be so. So I hate it when someone says money doesn't mean anything. It only means nothing when you've got it. When you haven't got it, it means everything. So these girls are smart and together girls. They are beautiful. They are gorgeous. And they do earn good money, but not every day. They are entrepreneurial, self-employed people. And they're smart. They've got to be smart to be able to talk to different people in different ways. Okay, they take the clothes off. But that's only part of the game. The rest of the game is entertainment. That's why I call them entertainers. Is money important to them? I should imagine immensely important to them. Are they enjoying it? I think they're enjoying it while they're making money. It's like anything else in life. If you're not making money, why are you working for it? So that's my answer. What about that?
That's a very good answer. Does it worry you? We've talked about age, but your children are very young and new baby on the way. Does that worry you that, please God, you're around for many, many years, but you're going to miss bits?
Of course. Only a fool would say no. Of course it does. And times when I have a serious moments in my life, and sometimes like anyone else, when you're in bed and you wake up at some ludicrous time in the middle of the night and and your optimism has left you, and you're still, you know, everything's a little bit colder than normal, and you think, well, this is not what I really, how I want it to finish, because I want my children to have the support of me. So the way I work that out, Peter, is that I'm going to make sure that they have some kind of trust fund that they can rely upon to at least assist them through life, as opposed to making it easy, because I don't want it easy for them. But neither am I that kind of guy that says I refuse to leave my children anything. I'm leaving my children everything I've got. Hopefully I've got enough to keep them happy in a financial manner for them to make their way through life at the education I'm hoping to give them.
What's the highest point of your very, very, very full life?
I don't think I've reached it yet. Listen, Peter, I'm in my office and people keep, you know what it is when you don't want it, people give you stuff. When you want it, nobody gives you nothing. You probably know that one yourself. I'm standing at the cupboard here. This lined up and full of vodkas, all different kind of vodkas. As I'm speaking to you, I'm thinking, what am I going to do with these? I've got bottles of vodka, bottles of champagne. These people come and, hey, would you like a bottle of this? What are you giving it to me for? Well, you might like it. I stopped drinking vodka 11 years ago. So I've got these bottles all over the place. And why am I telling you that? Only because, you know, what is the pinnacle? Yeah, success itself is a pinnacle. When I had my first taste of success, the Beatles' success was a pinnacle, a life changer, you know. And then after that, when I opened my own little club that I own, the King Mojo Club, that was the pinnacle. Watching the Kinks play at the Blue Moon Club when their record hit number one. Yeah, you really got me now. That was the pinnacle. Jumping all the way up to opening Cinderella's in Leeds when I held every penny that it had cost to build. And by the time Christmas, I'd opened it in August. By the time Christmas came round, I'd realised I was going to make some money. That was the pinnacle. And off it went. Success, each success becomes a pinnacle.
Peter, you've hit so many pinnacles. You must have so many pictures in your office.
Well, believe it or not, Peter, you know, this is where I become the cliche. Of course I've got pictures. I've got pictures in my office, their office, anybody's office that works for me, I've got pictures in it. We've still got boxes of photographs that we haven't had time to put up. But I just run you through. Each one points at a pinnacle in a funny way. Meeting the Queen in Miami, there's a pinnacle. With Philip with her. Meeting Margaret Thatcher when she came to Stringfellas. What about Paul McCartney? He's our Liverpool guy. Met him a couple of times with... Princess Diana. How about that? I'm looking at things that might impress people. What about Ginger Rogers? When she came to my party in my Beverly Hills club, I brought one of her Oscars with her, and she brought along James Stewart and brought his Oscar. Got Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye when they played piano together at Stringfellas. Tom Jones and me in New York, that was on. I'm just trying to find him. Old Kenny Everett when he was alive, of course. Mick Jagger, I'm just looking around here.
Yeah, amazing.
Who's that one again?
Who? Al Pacino.
Al Pacino.
You didn't get Al Pacino. Peter, how do I finish an interview with this? We've spoken for nearly an hour and it's touched a slight dint into your life. How do I finish this interview?
Well, you can finish it by here I am looking at something on my wall that you got me looking at. It was my first sign. It's about 2 foot by 2 foot maybe, which I hand-painted and put outside the church hall at St. Aidan's. In 1962, and it says, "Dig this, Daddy-O, rocking and twisting every Friday, 7:30 to 11, 3 shillings admission, top groups only."
Peter, I've got to say goodbye. Your final message to everybody, it's been a fascinating journey, and we've got to do it again because we could do it all over again, over and over again. Your message to everybody out there.
Well, folks, I gave you an hour. Only Peter Price could get that much out of me, I'll tell you now. I gave you an hour of my life when I've been around in business since 1962, 53 years. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope I got something over to you. I'd like to give a bit of advice where possible, but remember this. It's only you that can do it. It's no good following anybody else, whether you're on Twitter or whatever you're doing. Do it for yourself. Be happy. And thank you very much, Peter, for giving me a chance to, let go for a little while. It was fun. Thank you, Peter.